Our main speaker for this evening, Flo L. from Los Angeles.
You can bring that down a little bit. My name is Flo. I'm an alcoholic. Hello. Sean, what time do I go to? 45 minutes, okay. That's 8:58. The only clock is behind me, and I still haven't found eyes in the back of my head. I wish I did. I want to thank Lori for asking me to come and share with you guys. Thank you, Sean, for having me. I live in northern L.A. County, a little town called Castaic, but I got sober on the west side. And just to get the math out of the way, because I know we all want to know, I came in September of 1985, and I have not had a drink since my first meeting. But, lest we get ahead of ourselves, my sobriety date is April 7th of 1986, because I like smoking weed and snorting coke. So, yeah, let's clap for that, huh? Got me here much quicker, I will tell you that right now. I thought I was an alcoholic, so I stopped drinking alcohol. And what I realized is that I had to stop everything that affected me from the neck up. So it was weird, those first 7 months, kind of coming to meetings. I wouldn't get loaded before I came to meetings, but I'd get good and high when I left. And I get frustrated with guys that I work with, the newcomers, because they don't catch what's going on. They don't take in what we're talking about. And I was absolutely clueless when I was new. And I was an above average student. I consider myself a really bright guy and did not hear that whole thing about drugs for a long time. Just woo! So, but I kind of knew there was a problem, you know. I kind of knew that cocaine had me by the short hairs. And so the same thing happened for me when I drank as when I did coke. And that is, as soon as I took the first one, that just flipped a switch for me. And I wanted more. And I drank until I was full. That was the deal. When I never left a bar before last call unless it was to go to another bar or unless it was to take her home. You know what I mean? That's it. I never at 10:30 at night said, "Hey, Joey, close out my tab. I got to get up in the morning." Would not have occurred to me. Just that would be foreign. I want to thank Brian. I want to say thank you again to Brian for a great talk. Really nicely done. Yes. And then Is Linda with 28 years here? You are? Would you come up for a minute, hon? We didn't get a chance to hear from you during the birthdays. Would you do that for us? Come on. That is a big deal. So I want you to take a minute or two and just tell us how you did it. Happy birthday. Nicely done.
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry I was late. My name's Linda. I'm an alcoholic, and I am extremely grateful to be sober. I came to AA because I literally had no place else to go. I wound up on the street, and I couldn't stop drinking enough to take care of myself on the street, so I went to detox to have a safe place to stay. And I was in denial about being an alcoholic. I didn't really think I was an alcoholic. I thought, I'll just dry out for a couple days, and I'll be okay. Someone from H&I came in and shared about the desperation they felt when they needed a drink, and I could relate to that. And it's like, okay, so I am an alcoholic, but I'm less of an alcoholic, you know. But I went through the 7-day program, and they talked a lot about progressiveness, and I could relate to that. I could see the progressiveness in my life, how things just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to drink and be okay anymore, and I did not want to go back to, you know, life the way it was. So I was given the gift of desperation. I was given a moment of clarity and the gift of desperation, and I became real willing to do whatever. And I still didn't really believe AA was going to work, but I just, you know, I had nothing to lose by trying. If it kept me from drinking for just a little while, I'd just, you know, be that much better off. So I did what was suggested, even though I thought a lot of the ideas were stupid. I thought it was stupid that I should read my big book because, you know, that was written so long ago. Don't you guys know times have changed? But I read it, and you know what? It really helped me with my sobriety. It helped me to understand myself as an alcoholic, and it helped me to learn the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And It really contributed to my sobriety, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps to the best of my ability, and I reached out for a higher power, which was not something I wanted to do. I worked on my resentments, which was not something I wanted to do. I just did whatever was suggested to stay sober, and today I know this program works, and I know I have to keep doing these things, whether I have 20 days or 28 years. You know, I need to maintain my conscious contact with my higher power and stay connected to this program to stay sober. And life is good today, so thanks.
Nicely done, Linda. Happy birthday to all the birthday people. And congratulations if you're new. I had a chance to chat with Tim and Melissa out front who are new. And I want to talk to the people that are new for just a minute. If this is kind of your first pass through Alcoholics Anonymous or you're relatively new, I'd like you to stay here with us. Just stay. People are going to tell you a lot of things you have to do, and you're going to feel bad because you don't do them. How many people rushed into the steps here? Can I see a show of hands, right? That one girl is well in the back. Talk to her after we're done. She'll help you out. So, but I invite you to stay here with us. I invite you to get to the meeting early and chat with people. I'd like to invite you to stay and put the chairs together or help clean up when you're done. And get to know us, because I think if you get to know us, you'll want to be here with us. And yes, getting a sponsor is important. Yes, working the steps is important, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But I think the two most important things you can do right now, if you're new, is get a commitment, because that'll force you to come here and be with us. Because I don't know about you, but I won't get out of bed for me. I'll close the blinds, you know, porn and chocolate, whatever it takes. You know what I mean? Like, we're holed up. We're in there. We're not going anywhere. It's depression. That's what we're doing. But if I have to show up for you, I will get up, I will shower, I will get out of bed and be here, because I don't want to look bad and I don't want to let you down. And so the first thing I invite you to do is get a commitment. And the second thing I invite you to do is get and read this book. You know, Linda talked about the fact that it was written in 1938. And obviously, if you look around the room, our membership has greatly diversified. But in 1938, the men that came together and formed Alcoholics Anonymous were white businessmen, white collar, heterosexual, Christian, primarily lived in cities. And we have changed a lot of that. But sometimes the language here reflects that. It's no accident that we call the person who helps us through the steps our sponsor. These were businessmen, right? So that's where the word comes from. Someone who sponsored you. Someone who basically paid to look out for your well-being, was responsible for you. And so, but there is magic in this book. There is absolute magic in this book. It is a spiritual tome, which means I can read it over and over and over and over again and get something different out of it each time I read it, because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to continue to change and grow. Now, I'm 33 years sober. If you're doing the math, I finally got sober in April of 86, and I figure I'm going to be well, like the girl back there, somewhere about my 197th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. So there's a lot of room for growth for me. But I'm not the same guy I was 5 weeks ago. I'm not the same guy I was 5 months ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I continue to change and grow. Now, you will see some people in these rooms, and I don't want to judge. I judge no man. But you will see some people in these rooms that tend to be the same person all the time. And that's not why I got here. I want it all. You know what I mean? I want the pain that goes with the growth. So, I was born in Philadelphia in 1957. Dad was a doctor. Mom was a nurse. They hooked up at the hospital. She was quite a bit older, and beneath his station in life, they had a little affair. 9 months later comes this bouncing baby boy, and he split. You know, he married and moved to California and had a family. And so my mom, who's a good Catholic, had a bastard child. And that was frowned on. There weren't a lot of single mothers in those days. So we stood out for a couple reasons. One, I had a single mom. Two, if you are Irish Catholic in Philadelphia or New York or Boston, if you don't have at least 8 kids, you're not trying. You know what I mean? You're not in the game. Like, there's something wrong with dad. They don't blame it on mom. They blame it on dad. And so I'm an only child with a single mother. And consequently, I had to be good. If I were a good boy, that would justify Ellie's decision to essentially commit a sin. And that is to have a child out of wedlock. And everyone say, my real name's Alan. Flo's a nickname I've had since I was a little kid. And everyone would say, look what a good boy Alan is. Ellie's doing such a good job of raising him on her own. And so in the big book, it talks about the actor and living our double life. And I learned that at an early age. I could hit my mark. I could say my lines, yes, sir, no, ma'am, smile, entertain the adults, and run the streets at night and get in trouble. And so I learned how to do that. My mother hung out with other single nurses. Some of them were moms. Very few. Most of them were not. I had one other friend, Jackie, that I grew up with, and he had a single mom. And the sinners kind of hung out together. But so the other thing that happened for me is at a very early age, I learned how to walk into a room full of women and put them in the palm of my hand. Because the girls would all get together. There'd be 7, 8, 10 nurses having drinks, and I would be the one kid running around. I don't know, back in the 50s and 60s, much more than today, there was a drink called a Manhattan, which is a bourbon drink, but it's sweetened with vermouth. Does anyone know the garnish for a Manhattan? Maraschino cherry, that's right. And so I would run around and I would eat all the cherries in their drinks, and then I got to running around and finishing the drinks. So at an early age, I learned how to entertain women, but I was scared to death of men. I didn't have a dad. My grandfather died when I was about a year old, had no male influence in my life. And so from a very early age, I was stuck with this quandary, this kind of conundrum of what it takes to be a man. Now, when you're 5 and 6 years old, this is not stuff you should be worrying about. But I was worried about it. And I looked at television because I just didn't fit in. I was kind of a mama's boy. I didn't fight. I didn't play sports that well because I didn't have a dad to do that stuff with or brothers to do that stuff with. And so I looked at television and I watched shows like the first run of Star Trek with Captain James T. Kirk as the captain of the Enterprise, and he was badass, and he beat up the aliens, and he chased the alien women, you know what I mean? And there was a show called The Wild Wild West with Robert Conrad as Jim West. He was like a Secret Service agent back in the 1860s, and he was badass. And one of my other favorite shows, there was a show about an L.A. private detective called Mannix. Mannix was a hard-drinking, hard-fighting detective, and in 60 minutes he was going to solve the case. And one of my other favorite shows was called It Takes a Thief, and they have ripped off this idea 1,000 times since then, but basically Robert Wagner got caught, and he had to work for the good guys, kind of like the bad guy working for Mission Impossible. Anyway, I watched all these male role models on TV, and what I saw were people that could, within an hour span of the television show, they were inundated with a conflict, with a problem. They were given a situation which had no solution, and they formulated a plan, and they solved the problem by the end of the show, and they won the day. And, of course, usually there was a different female co-star every week, and they somehow managed to weave that into the plot as well. And so here I am watching TV, but out in the world I'm scared to death. I'm completely fear-driven. And we moved from Philadelphia to New York, and that was scary. And I started going to junior high in New York, and I don't know what came first, whether it was weed or booze, but I kind of found my way. You know what I mean? I found a way to be comfortable with the other boys, even with the older kids. Because if you walked up with a warm six-pack Friday night down at the Fireman's Field, you were welcomed in, at least till it ran out. You know what I mean? And I'm a little reticent to mention this, but we started with Boone's Farm apple wine. Yeah, I don't know if anyone remembers that. You could probably get more of a buzz from Diet 7-Up. But anyway, that's where we started, and we quickly graduated. We drank a lot of beer. I grew up in the 70s. There were no mothers against drunk driving. I grew up in New York. The drinking age was 18. So by the time I was 16, I had my own six-pack in the fridge. And nobody cared. Nobody wondered. There were bars in Rockville Center where I grew up where you could go in there and swing a bowling ball on a chain and not hit anyone that was over 18. Not hit anyone but the bartender and the bouncer that are of legal drinking age. And it was just very much accepted. Our parents went to fight in World War II. They came home, they bought a house, they paneled the wall in the basement, and they built a bar, and that's what they did. And so drinking was very normal where I grew up. And I promised my mom in high school, I was drinking and smoking a lot of weed, and I said, look, my other friends are doing drugs. I don't do that. I'm a straight-A student. This is what I'm going to do. And it worked. It worked all through college. When I was in high school, I will tell you that I was in an all-honors track. I was in advanced classes. And I wouldn't tell people because I was ashamed of it. Now, that's alcoholism. I had alcoholism before I started drinking. I have alcoholism whether I'm drinking or not. And kids would see me in gym class, and they'd go, I never see you in any of my classes. And I wouldn't tell them that's because I'm in the honors track. You know, I'd just say, oh, just luck of the draw. That's what happened. And it worked. It worked for a while. I went away to college. I had a bunch of AP credits. Is there any way we could open that door a little bit? I'm schwitzing up here. That would be so great. Just a little cross breeze. Sweet. If anyone gets cold, let me know. Hi out there. How are you? See, she's smart. I went away to college, and I started out the first semester with a 4.0. I aced all my classes, and I said, I know how to do this. By the time I was a senior in college, I had a C average, and I couldn't show up for class, and I never graduated because it just became more important to get loaded. I started working as a bartender in college. Excuse me, again, it's hot up here. I started working as a bartender in college, and I'll tell you two stories about how I roll. So the first bar I worked at was called the Red Lion. It was in Washington, D.C. Again, drinking age is 18. In Washington, the drinking age is 18 for beer and wine and 21 for alcohol. Once you got through the door, no one cared. So I'm bartending underage, and Washington rarely got snowstorms, but we had 4 feet of snow one night. So I closed the bar. Everyone ate acid. We stayed open all night. Left it exactly the way we left it. And I got a call at 9 in the morning that I was fired because literally the door was open and there were glasses and dishware everywhere. That's how I got fired from that bar. But just to show you that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable, the second bar I worked at was a bar called The Exchange. Now, I'm in Washington, D.C. This is probably 2 blocks from the old executive office building. The old executive office building is where the White House staff works. So right in downtown D.C. And I was a DJ on Friday night, and I worked the main bar on Saturday night. And Friday night, I drank a little too much. In a blackout, I turned over both turntables. The dance floor stops, and I stormed out. I was angry at someone. To this day, I don't know what happened. I think I can find my manager on Facebook, and so I want to ask him. But so the next day, I walk in to do my bartending shift, and I hit the door at about 5:30, and Joel, who's my manager, and we butt heads all the time, this big smile lights on his face. He's just so happy to see me. He's never happy to see me. I go, what are you smiling at? He goes, I fired you last night. So I get fired in a blackout and talk about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I go back the next night and get fired again. So that's how I do it. So I don't think we have to wonder if I have a problem with alcohol. As I mentioned, I couldn't manage to graduate from GW, so I moved to California and I started working in the restaurant business. It's very common for us. How many people, waitresses, waiters, bartenders, cooks? Yeah, there you go. I know you're here. Don't be ashamed. Get your hand up. It's okay. And I started working in the LA bar scene. In Los Angeles, when you work in a restaurant, you go to work at 5:30, you work your ass off for 4, 5, 6 hours, you walk out with a pocket full of money, and everyone goes to another bar and spends their money. That's just what we did. I worked in Marina Del Rey. There was a bar called Fiasco. And Marina Del Rey has all these beach bars. There's, you know, the Beachcomber, and there's the Warehouse, and the Chart House, and the Red Onion, and TGI Fridays, and everyone has a ridiculous uniform. I worked at the Baja Cantina. We had white OP shorts. I had a red polo with the Baja Cantina logo on one side, my name tag on the other. I had a little waist apron that I tied. And when I got off work, I can't tell you how many times I got home at 8 in the morning after partying all night, and I'd still have the apron on. Like, I was too busy just to untie the apron and take it off because I had to get to drinking, right? And So we would go to Fiasco, and all those restaurants would be at different tables, and everybody knew each other, because on our nights off, you would go to someone else's bar, and you would sit there and drink with a friend or a girlfriend for 6 hours, and you'd get a bill for $17, and you'd throw 80 bucks on the bar, and that's how you rolled. And we all took care of each other, and we stole blind from all the restaurant owners we worked for. And that's just what you did, and I made those amends. So at some point, we would rush down to Boys Market to get a bottle if we were lucky. If not, you end up at somebody's house in Marina Del Rey, and you're going through their cabinets, and there's like dessert wine or sherry, and at 3 a.m, it just doesn't matter. You'll drink anything. Let's mix that with soda and see what it tastes like, right? So we were doing other drugs, and you'd stay up all night, and finally, the guy in the marina had the really million-dollar house figured out. He wasn't getting any, so he would kick you out. You'd end up at somebody's house in Culver City, and in the 80s, there was a lot of nothing on TV after 2 or 3 in the morning. There was just nonsense. And so we'd play Trivial Pursuit, or we'd have video cassettes and watch them, and at 6 in the morning, I'd be standing in a parking lot with a couple friends of mine, and I'd go, let's go get a six-pack. You know, let's call the dealer again. Well, he was pissed when we woke him at 3. Well, he took our money then. You know what I mean? And I just had to keep it going. Because if it ended and I was alone, I was with me. You know what I mean? I'm 28 years old. All my friends from college that got a degree, they're doctors and lawyers and agents and accountants. And they work in their dad's business, and they're starting to get married and have kids, and they have a house. I work 3 nights a week in Marina Del Rey in a bar at 5:30, and it's everything I can do to show up at 5:30 for that job. And I hate myself. I don't know about any of you, but when you were little, did anyone hear how great you were going to be or how much potential you had? Anyone relate to that? I heard how much, you know, Ellie's little shining star was going to be great. And, you know, in my late 20s, I had no life, I had no prospects, I had no future, I had nothing going on. And I hated myself. There was nothing wrong, you know what I mean? I just didn't like myself. And so I would say to them, let's get a six-pack, let's keep it going. And they'd go, you know what, look, see that guy that just drove by? See the girl? She's adjusting her makeup in her mirror. It's today for them. They just woke up, they took a shower, they shaved, they're all nice and pretty, right? They are going to work today. It is yesterday for you. Go to bed. Go to bed. You have to work at 5. You don't want to push through. Go get a few hours sleep. And that's what I would do. I would go home, and I would pull some speakers out on the front lawn, and I'd drink a six-pack to fall asleep, and I'd crank the music. It was Venice, though. My neighbors must have thought I was crazy, but everybody was crazy. And I'd sleep for 3 or 4 hours. I'd wake up. I'd go run. I had a little six-mile loop that I ran before I went to work. Because if you're running 10Ks and half marathons, you can't be an alcoholic or an addict. I have 10% body fat. Come on. And I would just crawl through a shower. My head would be throbbing. My mouth would be dry and just taste of cigarettes. And I would get in the car to go to work, and on the way to work, I'd say, I'm not drinking today. I'm just not. I feel like shit. I'm dying here. I'm not going to drink today. I'm just going to go to work. I'm going to wait on people. I'm going to count my money. I'm going to count the till. I'm going to have a Coke and go home, and then tomorrow morning, I'll get up and take care of all those things I've been avoiding. You know, I don't know if they still do that now, because you pay it online. But back in the 80s, your bills would come and there'd be a little window, and the window would be white, right? Because it was this month's bill. And then it would be yellow. And then it would be pink. And then it would be red. You know what I mean? And shit was getting turned off all the time, and I'd have bench warrants, and I got a couple boots on my car, and I just couldn't attend to life. I could not attend to life. And so I got a DUI in 1980. I took a couple Quaaludes. I hit 4 parked cars. They were in a row. I'm pretty proud of that. I didn't kind of ping-pong down the street. I just got it all done at once. And I'm such an idiot, I wouldn't pee. Like, it's drugs. It's not alcohol. It's not going to be picked up in the urine. I should have given them the test, and they ended up taken my blood, and so I got popped. And so I pled guilty to that. I got another one in 1985. I blew a 1.9. I do want to say, you hear people tell prodigious stories in here. They drank, you know, they drank a fifth a day. They drank a handle a day. They did an eight ball every other hour. You hear all this stuff. It does not matter how much you drank. Does not matter what form your alcohol came in. There might be a program if that's all you did that's more appropriate for you. But if you drank and did all those other things too, I invite you to identify as an alcoholic and stay here with us in Alcoholics Anonymous. But you're going to hear people tell stories, and I've never met an alcoholic that can't keep score. And so you're going to say, well, I'm not that bad. I never did prison time. You know what I mean? Like, I never went to a psych ward. I never turned yellow. Doesn't matter. This is a self-diagnosed disease. So it doesn't matter how much it took you. The idea is, like I said, when I took a drink, the drink took me. And we were going till I was done. That's just it. We're going till I'm done. And so if that's your experience, the big book talks about it. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. The allergy of the body simply means when I get something good, I want more of it right now. Let's just keep it coming. And I always overshoot the mark. Okay, alcohol is going to intoxicate you. That's its job. So there was a certain point where you were intoxicated enough. I never stopped at that point. I kept shooting for more. And the obsession of the mind simply means, you know what, this time it's going to be different. Like I said, I would drive to work saying, I'm not going to drink tonight. And then somewhere around 7 o'clock, I would think to myself, because I got money on the game. The TV's up here. The cocktail waitress is here, and she's yelling for drinks. I'm like, hold on, baby. I want to see this play. I want to see this at bat, right? Or five guys have dinner and leave me a $2 tip. I'm like, what's up with that? Or whatever it was, somebody would upset me, and at 7 o'clock I would say, you know what, at the end of the night I deserve a cold beer. And so usually by the end of happy hour, your ice well is empty. And I would take a Corona, and I'd just kind of push it down in the bottom till it was flat on the steel, right? And then I would cover it with ice, you know, like big buckets of ice. And for the rest of the night, I'd be scooping that out of ice to make drinks. And then finally around 10:30, 11 o'clock, that bottle would pop its little head out of my ice well. I'd be like, yeah, that one's going to be cold. That's going to be perfect, right? And then somewhere around 11 o'clock, it went from I'm going to have a beer to I'm getting wasted. You know, I get caught getting steak out of the kitchen again. Employees aren't supposed to have steak. The girl that is waiting for me when I get off leaves with him. You know, or somebody else does something to piss me off, and I say, you know what? I deserve this. Now, I will tell you, if you had put a lie detector on me while I was driving to work, when I said, I'm not going to drink tonight, the needle wouldn't move. I meant it. I meant it every single time. But yet, in a few short hours, that had gone out the window, and it was on. And one more time, I'm standing outside at 7 in the morning with my friends, and they're like, get away, you're evil, go home, we're done. That's enough. We'll see you tonight. And so that's my experience with the disease of alcoholism. If you have alcoholism like I do, like I said, I have it whether I am drinking or not. And so people say to me, you have 33 years without a drink. Why the hell do you still go to those meetings? And I tell them, look, if you could travel around in these 4 inches up here between my temples for one day, 24 hours right here. Imagine, for those of you old enough to remember, the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. You were sitting in Captain Kirk's chair in my head. Remember when they used to be in battle and they would kind of like move around on the set like they were getting hit with torpedoes? That's what it, you would, at the end of those, actually, forget 24 hours. At the end of 3 hours, you would hop out of the chair and go, look, I'll drive you to meetings for the next year. I'll be here tomorrow night at 7:30. I got you. You know what I mean? Because I'm absolutely insane. And so I continue to attend Alcoholics Anonymous for two reasons. One, because the steps are designed to treat my thinking. The steps are not designed, thank God, the steps are not designed to treat your circumstances. Your circumstances will get better here. You will come in here, you'll start to, you know, some of the arrest warrants will go away, you'll start to get a job back, you'll get a car, maybe you'll get him or her back or find a new him or her, you get a little nicer apartment. All these things will happen in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But that's not the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. The purpose of the steps is to address my thinking. Thank God. Because by nature, I am selfish and self-centered and just stuck in me. I've been in my head a lot for the last couple weeks. I'm having problems at work. this is going to be shocking to you, of my own making, right? I have a gift in an auditorium like this for finding the rake, stepping on the rake, and catching the handle right in the nose all the time. It is just a gift. And so I have not been completely honest about situations at work, and I've put my job and my staff in jeopardy by doing that. And I'm 33 years sober. I work a hell of a program. I sponsor a lot of guys. I'm very active. I go to 5 to 7 meetings a week. I do all that stuff. But I say that because I have to continue to come back and treat my alcoholism. You know what I mean? I have alcoholism whether I am drinking or not. And to drink would just send everything off the rails. So one day at a time, my job tonight is just for me to hit my pillow without taking a drink. That's the whole thing. Just to get to my pillow and then tomorrow get up and do it again. And the other thing I'll say, if I do tomorrow what I did today, I'll stay sober. You know, if I get down on my knees and pray. If I answer the phone when my sponsees call and I just really don't want to talk to them. You know what I mean? If I read a little bit of spiritual literature, I go to a big book study on Saturday mornings, and we read the big book cover to cover. And so this time we thought we would try the first edition. They have a red and yellow big book out now. And so we're reading the stories in the first edition. And it's remarkable to me. There were 30 stories in the first edition other than Bill Wilson, our founder, and Dr. Bob Smith. And of those 30 stories, 6 of them stayed sober. The other thing that's really interesting about reading this book is up to that point, they were working a program loosely based on the Oxford group, and they had their own kind of 5 or 6 step groove that they were doing. When the big book was actually published, nobody had worked the steps yet, the 12 steps. They were new. They were novel. And yet we've now lived with them for 80 years, and it's been remarkable. So we're reading these stories. And the other thing is, by 1938, it says when you open the book, it says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. In the initial book, it says the story of over 100 men who have recovered from alcoholism. And at the time they wrote the big book in 1938, there were probably 12 people that had a year. Everybody else was new. So the stories in the book are the first 6 months of sobriety of these people. Some of the stories of the guys who stayed sober are longer in the second, third, and fourth edition. But it's remarkable reading this. And alcoholism kills people. Addiction kills people. You don't have to believe me to know that. How many people in this room know of somebody that has died of alcoholism or addiction in the last year? I want everyone, keep your hands up. Look around. This is deadly serious. Like, stay here with us. Stay here with us. So in the story we read this morning, the guy it's 4 pages and 3 3/4 pages are him getting loaded, and then he gets sober in like the last paragraph because he was relatively new. But the third step talks about made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And he said something in his story in that last paragraph, which I thought was remarkable. He said, I'm going to let God do all the caring. I'm going to let God do all the caring. Because I've made these mistakes in my work situation, my head is overtime, just running all the time. Because I care so much about this and I don't want it to go south. But I have to let go of that. I have to let God do all the caring. The mind will outlast the body 100 out of 100 times. You know what I mean? It just never stops. No matter what happens to our body, we get tired, we get sick, it just keeps going. And so again, the steps are designed to treat my thinking, thank God. So I looked up, before the meeting, the definition of care. The first one I like is the provision of what is necessary for the health, welfare, maintenance, and protection of someone. The provision of what is necessary for the health, welfare, maintenance, and protection of someone. And then the caring that he talked about in the book is feel concern or interest, attach importance to something. And I'm going to let God do all of that. It's really hard. I invite you to read the stories of the pioneers in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't have a book. They didn't have big meetings like this. You know, they got sober, and I got him sober right here, and I said, you got to go by train, go down to Cleveland and picked this guy up, and I gave him a bottle so he could nurse him to come back. He went down there. He told the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. We work with other people. This is how we get sober. We stay sober by helping other drunks, and we share together. And he did such a good job telling him that he has a drink, so then he's nursing him back to Akron. You know what I mean? He was going to be his sponsor, and now the tides have turned, and he's the sponsor bringing him back. But they threw people into work right away with other alcoholics. And so I invite you, if you're here and you want to stay, we have a target-rich environment. People raise their hands in their first 30 days. You don't have to sponsor them. You may not be at your fourth step yet, or at your ninth step yet, or at your 11th, so whatever it is. But you can give them your number, save them a seat, remember their name, introduce them to your friends. You have permission to start working with people right now. Check with your sponsor, because I tend to piss people off. I have a gift. But you have permission to start working with people now. The other thing I want to give you permission to do, and again, I tend to piss people off with this, but I'm going to say it anyway, and that is, I invite you, if you're new and you're having trouble getting into the book and you're reading Bill's story and out of World War I, what's this about? Read 86, 87, and 88 right away. Just go right there. I give you permission, talk to your sponsor, to begin the 11th step right now, to have some quiet time, to have some prayer in the morning, to ask God to direct your thinking. You know what I mean? That it be divorced from self-pity, self-seeking, and dishonest motives. Get into that now. That is so powerful, because I don't know about you, but my head wakes up before me. And so if I get to 86, 87, and 88 in the morning, I have a better day. It's just the way it works. I always read something from the big book when I share. How we doing? We got about 5 minutes. Perfect timing. So again, I invite you to get to know the early AA, because that's what we're designed after. I think I'm going to get on my soapbox now, but my soapbox is probably backed up by something that's in here. So if you get angry, I'd be happy to point that out for you. But I feel like the greatest sin, I won't say sin, I don't want to be religious, the greatest disappointment in Alcoholics Anonymous is people that come into the program. They work the steps, they get a sponsor, they get through 4 through 9, they make the amends, now they have a 10th step so they can say, you know what, I was an asshole, I was wrong, I want to apologize for that, and I want to ask you what I can do to make that right. Or, and they start having a spiritual program, they start having a spiritual practice, they pray in the morning, they meditate, whatever that is. But then when it comes to sponsoring people or doing the 12th step, they say, you know what, my sponsor's really good at that. That secretary guy, he sponsors everybody. He's really good at that. I have young kids. I travel a lot for business. I'm not dependable. It's just not for me. You know what I mean? And I believe that when Bill and Bob wrote this book, they meant for everybody to sponsor at least one person and to enjoy the magic of taking someone else through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, again, my opinion. You can come up and argue with me if you want. That's okay. But I really believe you're losing out if you don't do that. When I went to a party, I hung out in the back and drank beer at the keg. I was in the kitchen because the Stoli was in the fridge and it was ice cold. But I wanted to be upstairs in the master bedroom where they were doing the really good stuff, right? That's where I wanted to be. So I want to be wherever the best is, and the best is for us to have the opportunity to take someone else through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to share our experience, strength, and hope. We save lives here. How many people saw the Avengers movie? What? Do they have theaters in San Diego? What's going on here? There we go. We get to wear the cape and the tights here. That's what we get to do. And with good reason, we celebrate our firemen, we celebrate our soldiers, we celebrate the policemen and law enforcement. We celebrate them because they save lives. Everyone in this room has the opportunity to be a hero and save lives, because we can reach someone when no one else can, because we have the experience. Okay, I'm going to read this and shut up. This is from A Vision for You, and this talks about early AA in Akron, Ohio. Many a man, yet dazed from his hospital experience, has stepped over the threshold of the home into freedom. This was the Williams home, where they had the early meetings in Akron. Many an alcoholic who entered there came away with an answer. He succumbed to that gay crowd inside who laughed at their own misfortune and understood his. Impressed by those who visited him at the hospital, he capitulated entirely when later, In an upper room of the house, he heard the story of some man whose experience closely tallied with his own. The expression on the faces of the women, that indefinable something in the eyes of the men, the stimulating and electric atmosphere of the place conspired to let him know that here was haven at last. The very practical approach to his problems, the absence of intolerance of any kind, the informality, the genuine democracy, the uncanny understanding which these people had were irresistible. That is what makes this a program of attraction, not promotion. Our job, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, is to make this attractive enough for you to come back tomorrow. If I could break the program down into one idea or one phrase, that is, come with us. Please come with us. Thanks for letting me share.